Okay, so what I'd like to do today is start talking about something. Okay, so up till now we've been talking about what I will say are arbitrage type. We're talking about what I will say is the fundamentals of why stocks get priced, different theories for how stocks get priced. We have an arbitrage theory, we have this capital assets pricing model theory, okay? And it's clear that they are existing, exerting influences as to what can happen with price data. What I'd like us to now shift into for the next several weeks is more of a question about sort of empirical data analysis, okay? How do we analyze what I will say is the primary kind of data that arises in financial in financial data analysis, that of time series data. Okay, I mean, a time series is a collection, is a, basically the values of a function sampled at different points in time. Okay, that is what is meant by a time series. And time series arise, you know, all the time in natural and physical sciences and things like that. What time series data has anybody ever played with? Has anybody in here ever played with any time series data on any subject? Okay, is aware of any time series data? What kind of, put anyone in the spot, okay? Yeah? So one thing that you might be doing is you may be a computer network person and you'll be interested in what is the packets. You know, what is the level of network activity as a function of time, right? So you probably have some graph that, in some paper you've written where you sort of plot that the amount of network traffic, let's say network traffic is here as a function of time, okay? And you've probably seen pictures to the effect where, well, you know, nobody wakes up before 9 o'clock, so there's no network traffic till 9. Then it sort of goes up and up until lunch. Dumps a little bit at lunch, okay? So you can imagine a time series plot, then it goes down, you know, maybe goes back after lunch. At the end of the day, it drops for dinner. Then the graduate students come in late at night and it gets busy, and so on, okay? So that is a good example of a time series. We are, again, what we typically are doing in a time series like that is that we are sampling the function of network traffic as a function of time. And the plot here maybe is sort of an aggregate time plotted per hour. But in general, what we have is in each day and time, there is a network amount of network traffic, and it presumably oscillates somewhat. Okay, and the time series data are samples of it. Okay, and we're trying to figure out something about that, about the behavior of the network from that. Okay, any questions? Any other time series data that people have played with? Yes. Temperature during the day, okay? So certainly people encounter, plots of the temperature during the day, okay? And, typically the min, I happen to know, what time of day is the minimum temperature reach? Trivia, I'm just curious if anybody has any intuition. Roughly what time of day? Right before sunrise, which somehow surprised me a little bit. Maybe it probably makes perfect sense, but I was recently reading this. And it sort of surprised me that it is basically right before sunrise. So basically the temperature is going to be declining up until sunrise. And then sort of goes up with the day. And then when sunset happens, it starts to decay. Okay, and again, we've got a sinusoidal type curve here. Okay? What? 2 p.m. is maybe when it starts to decay. And of course, we also have on top of that time series something else that's interesting. That's the time series for any particular day. You also have the time series for any particular year, where if you actually roll out the full time series, okay, of temperature data for the year, what's going to happen? Every day you've got these little wiggles, okay? But presumably in winter, they're wiggling lower than they are in summer. And the wiggles are going to peak and go down like this. Okay? So, the time series behavior of temperature is going to get very complicated. you know, that's sort of explained by a couple of cycles. There's the cycle of the year, the cycle of the day, okay? And so what a time series analysis would like to do is to make sense of that kind of thing, okay? Any other time series people have any, experience with? Yeah. Tourism throughout the year probably correlates in general fairly well with temperatures and stuff like that. Okay, so that's another plot, okay? Any other time series? Yeah. So in here, we are interested in financial series. In general, we're going to be interested in stock prices like, okay, I mean, prices of assets. Basically, what is the price of an asset as a function of time? That naturally gives you a curve, okay? I mean, presumably everybody has seen, stock price, plot of the day's stock price activity. And, you know, usually what happens is there was an openness, or there was a closing price from yesterday, there was an opening price, it wiggles around a little bit, Alan Greenspan speaks, okay, it wiggles around a little bit, and looks something like that for the day, okay? Any questions about that? And if we sort of roll this out for, so there are lots of different financial time series we get. There's a price during the day, sampled at great frequency. You know, sometimes there is a current market price, you can think of it. Or historically, you're probably talking about the scale of, gee, what was the price did it close at every day of the year? You know, was it a stock that had a good year, in which case its closing prices probably went like this? Okay, or did it have a bad year, or did it go down? Stuff like this. So it should be clear that the reason why we're going to care about time series analysis in here is because financial data is largely represented as time series. Does everybody agree with that? Okay. The other thing to note is that many other economic statistics that we're going to be, that kind of become interested in are also thought of as time series data. Okay? So, for example, if you measure the unemployment rate, the unemployment rate is a function of time, right? They typically announce new statistics every week or so. The price of the yen versus the dollar is a time series, right? The index of leading economic indicators, or the index of consumer confidence, these things typically are represented by a numerical value that changes, you know, that's a function of time, okay? And looking at how these values affect prices is certainly a fair game and things that people are interested in. Any questions? Okay? We're going to be interested in time series analysis. Really, time series data arises in lots and lots of applications. And it is a well-developed field. The question of time series analysis. I am not an expert on time series analysis, okay? But there are a wide variety of mathematical tools and statistical tools for working with time series data that we're going to try to sort of develop over the next couple of weeks, okay, as I try to figure it out, okay? Any questions about that? Okay, now, one thing to notice that's going to be different about about these time series, let's think about some properties that these time series may have. Which of the time series we've had are subject to, let's say, experimental error, okay, where there's a measurement error on the value of the function, okay? Yeah? Well, okay, the stock market, I would say, probably in general, there is not really a measurement error associated with it, okay? I would like to think that in general, basically, the stock price is set, yes? Temperature reading is data where I will claim that there clearly is measurement error in it, right? So a lot of, let's say, classical time series analysis has to do with data error filtering and stuff like this. Does everybody sort of agree with that? That component is probably not going to be present in financial data, except that you sort of may picture stock prices or financial prices as having a sort of true value, that there's sort of these local fluctuations because as the market starts to settle on a value, right? that sort of makes sense somehow, that if you look at stock prices very close up, there's a tremendous amount of minute-by-minute fluctuation, okay? And for some purposes, you're going to want to filter that out, and for some purposes, that might be interesting to you, okay? So these are some of the issues that will come up in time series analysis. Any questions? Okay? Again, some people have heard in here about technical analysis of stocks. Technical analysis of stocks is this field that seems to be worried about, if you look at the time series before, you see some stock has done this, what's it going to do next? Okay? And there's certain people, if you believe in technical analysis, you believe you can take a look at the past history of a stock and make a guess as to what it will do next. Okay? So those kind of people spend a lot of time looking at time series. Okay? Now these kind of people also disagree with the principles that we have talked about so far, when we talked about a capital assets pricing model as somehow being that they're sort of everything that we know about, okay, or market, but everything we know about the stock up till now is rolled up in the price currently, including the past history. So if you believe that, the past history doesn't have much meaning, okay? But I claim that there's a lot of people who are looking at time series. Some of them may be flaky, okay? But even if not, there are good reasons to look at time series, okay? If you want to evaluate an investment strategy, you're going to be basically comparing it to historical time series data, okay, and trying to make something sense about it. If you're trying to predict how much risk a particular stock has now, you've got to do something with the time series data. That's the only real evidence you have of what the risk of it is. Okay? And if you want to study whether an arbitrage strategy is successful or not, you're going to have to look at historical data. That, I think, motivates us looking at time series analysis. Any questions about that? Okay, so that, I think, is all quite believable. Now, the first question is, what is a, you know, what time series should we in general be studying? Okay? So, the most natural time series for the price of a stock, again, I say asset, stocks somehow seem to be the easiest to think about because we have sort of some intuition about what they do. But the price of an asset is clearly the most natural time series associated with it. The price of General Motors is what this thing is doing, right? Your GM's price, it goes up and down. So we could try to analyze the stream of prices, okay, and try to subject that to mathematical analysis. In general, for many things that we're going to want to do, okay, the actual raw data stream is not, the raw stream of prices is not the most natural or the most reasonable way to model, to sort of somehow capture that notion of the data. And the argument I want to make for this has to do with, what do we expect the long-term price of a stock to be if we take a long enough period of time? Okay? Suppose that today, this is Microsoft back in 1930. Okay? Bill Gates got started earlier than we might have suspected. Okay? And his first Microsoft came out at $10 in 1930. What do we expect the price of Microsoft to look like if you look at it with a far enough resolution? Okay? Yeah? Okay, well, the price of it, by definition, is the total capitalization, okay, divided by the definition, divided by the number of shares. But what do we expect the stock price to do in the absence of splits, in the absence of anything like that? Yeah. Expect that in general the price is going to go up. And how is it going to go up? We would have to argue that the price should, modulo the wiggles, had better grow up exponentially. Why is that? Because if you think about it, each, you know, somehow we're competing with stock, bonds, or leaving it in the bank, okay? We know that sort of compound interest and all, that the amount of return you would expect at the risk-free rate is going to grow exponentially, correct? So you have a world where your stock prices, if you don't adjust them for splits or anything like that, okay, should grow exponentially. Okay? And that has certain weird, that has certain weird implications, I will claim. Okay? So, for example, what is the mean, the average stock price over a particular interval, okay, going to be? Okay, if I take, what was the average price of General Motors stock? Okay, is that something that has any real meaning? In an exponentially distributed world, I would argue that we would expect that the average price had better be near the current price, right? Because it's an exponentially growing function. Okay? I'll also argue that most of the mathematical tools that one thinks about with respect to analyzing time series, for example, correlation, sort of implicitly assume, either implicitly or explicitly, assume that we're working with linear functions. Okay? That makes sense, or, some of this can be finessed, presumably, to work with exponential functions. But it is much easier to think about linear functions, okay? Any questions about that? Is that sort of all belief? Okay? Yes? What I would argue is, if you want to say, what is the average price? Well, normally, if it was a linear function that was increasing, the average price would be in the middle. Does everybody agree with that? But look what happens if you have a function that's growing extremely rapidly. Okay? The average price is quite a bit lower than what you would get in the middle value. Does everybody see that? Okay? So now you may say, well, what meaning does the average price have over this interval? Well, I'm telling you it has no meaning if it's an exponentially growing function. Okay? If we are over a short enough period of time where the expected return is sort of zero, then maybe that has some kind of a meaning. Okay? But so my argument is that we're better off trying to get the prices away from something that grows exponentially to something that can be dealt with as a linear type thing. Okay? Any questions? So I would argue that a better way to represent the return would be if let's say piece of t is the function of what is the price at a particular time, the return at time t, we're going to say, is defined as, actually I may have spaced this wrong, so this side I think I'm going to believe in the formula, this I'm not. Okay? That the return of this is going to be t sub t, we'll define the return as being, forget what I have on the slide, dt over pt minus 1. Okay? So this is the price of time t, today's price over yesterday's price, that ratio minus 1. What makes that an increment? What properties would we expect the returns to have, okay, if we use that formula? Okay, the claim would be that the return should be between minus 1 and 1. I don't know if I necessarily believe that, okay? What happens if, I'm a little tiny drug company, and I suddenly announce that I have a cure for cancer. Okay? A patented cure for cancer. Suddenly I know my stock is going to go crazy, right? So what is the value of this return going to be? Infinite over zero, because it's always worth nothing at the beginning, minus 1, which is infinite. Okay? So there's no reason why on the upside this is going to be 1. Although, is there a reason why on the downside this is going to be mounted minus 1? Okay. Why is that? Why is that? Right, so the worst that can happen to you, okay, if you're an incorporated stock, is that the price can drop to zero, right? So if it goes bankrupt, the return that day is minus 1, okay? Any questions here? then again, one of the reasons why people form companies is so that the return, incorporate, is so in fact the return can never get to be worse than zero, and minus one. Because it's something that you've lost an incredible amount of money, you just go bankrupt and you owe nothing, as opposed to if they were sort of destined to come and haunt you or something like that. Okay? But it's certainly the case that one side is minus one, the other side is arbitrarily large. Okay, but what would the expected value of this function be? Okay? What would you predict that the return should be? If this is a return at time t, what do we think that the returns typically should be? Well, what? Okay, it's clear that if it's negative here, you've lost money, right? And that if it is positive, you have made money. And if it is zero, it is unchanged. Everybody agree with that? What would be sort of in life expected the average return is probably going to be? Somewhere clustered around zero, I mean, in general, if I want to think of it like this, you know. I mean, certainly for small periods of time, okay? One might argue that it goes as much positive as negative. Okay? We'll talk more about that later. The basic principles are here. We now have a value that is most likely, okay, if you sample it over short periods of time, going to be averaging around zero, okay, and presumably going positive, negative or positive, depending upon whether you have made or lost money. Any questions? Okay? So, return is nice for this because, first of all, let's think what properties we have about returns here. The claim is, first of all, that the return is one number that you can use to understand how your investment is doing. Okay, if my return is 6% per year, I know what I have done. Saying that GM is now $100 a share doesn't tell me anything. Does everybody agree with that? So a return, in some sense, does tell me how I'm doing. Okay, so that's one advantage of returns. What would the returns be if we had, let's say, a function like the risk-free rate? Let's say that we were tracking the risk-free rate. What would the return be, okay, under this? Okay? And what's the returns function going to look like? Suppose I plot the returns function, okay, for the risk-free rate, what am I going to be getting? It's going to be a constant function. Does everybody agree with that? Okay. A constant function that is presumably a little bit above zero, right? The amount, the return that I'm getting at one point is the same as the return I'm getting at another point. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? If a company is doing it, but this function now means that instead of inherently looking exponential, it looks linear, okay? It even looks sort of flat, okay? But does everybody agree that this is somehow more linear than what we were dealing with before? Okay? Any questions? Yes? The return, let's say, what I'm talking about here is suppose I have a 30-year treasury note or something like this thing, and just getting my interest from the bank, from the government every day. My return is going to be, I'm going to get a certain percentage of return each day, and the percentage I get in principle is the same. Okay? And if you want to picture this, you know, bond markets and things like that, that's not what I'm talking about here. Okay? But basically what we would expect is for Microsoft, what would Microsoft's return look like every day? Well, probably in general, their return is probably going to be better than the risk-free rate. It better be if we're going to justify Microsoft, right? And so you've probably got something that's wiggling around. Actually, to be precise, it's probably wiggling something like this. Here you have your axis. Here is zero. Here is minus one, meaning Microsoft has gone bankrupt, right? Here is the risk-free rate. Okay. It is probably, Microsoft is presumably doing something that is wiggling around here. Right? again, it may be the case that this is misleading to say Michael never got that close to bankruptcy. But on a day when it went negative, okay, on a day when it, when Microsoft lost money, went down, it would be negative. Okay? When it had an update, it was positive. And in general, it's going to have to wiggle so that it's mean. Again, the mean of this wiggle, I claim, if we smooth it out, is going to be above the risk-free rate. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? That would be sort of our image here. So I claim returns are going to be a better way to do this. Okay? And certain analyses that you do will be bad if you use prices instead of returns. Like, for example, I guess we were talking with our rapid response team was trying to correlate certain things. And they correlated prices and they correlated returns. Was there a difference? Did one look better? Which one looked better? Returns. Okay, so that's a proof. Okay? Any questions? Okay, good.
Now, one nice period, oh, by the way, just before I actually go too far beyond this, the material on time series analysis, I'm going to try to take, at least largely, from this book by Tsai. It's sort of the second book that I recommended for the course on financial time series analysis. There is some material like this in the Hull book, so grab the Hull book, you should feel around. It's in probably the middle chapters of the Hull book, but this is where I'm going to be trying to follow more closely. So, one nice period of studying returns is that we can use returns to use the daily returns, let's say, to give us the return over a longer period of time. Okay? So let's say we use our notation RT of K to be the return at time T over the previous K, since K periods of time ago. In general, RT is going to be, we'll assume it's 1. We talk about the previous day, and so we ignore that. Okay? The return, okay, is going to be basically given by PT over PT minus K, okay, the price K, current price versus the price K days ago. Okay? And this, okay, it can be obtained by multiplying the daily returns, okay, over the entire time period. So let's make sure that we sort of agree with that. Okay? My claim is that if you have the, you want to know what is PT over PT minus 2 days before, that I claim is PT over PT minus 1 times PT minus 1 over PT minus 2. Does everybody see how this cancels? Okay? And so in some sense, one of the nice things about using returns is we have a time series represented as returns to figure out the return over a multiple period. Okay? It's basically a product of multiplying them together. Any questions about that? Now, is it the product of averaging them together? Okay? One thing that we're going to have to be careful with in this business is the difference between arithmetic means and geometric means. Okay? What does this mean? Okay? What is, let's say, what is the average return, okay, over a period of time? What is the right way to think about that? Okay? Speaking as computer scientists who know nothing about statistics, okay, the natural way to do it, let's say I want to figure out what is the average return, okay, over a period of K samples, okay? Naturally, I would take the returns and compute the arithmetic average of them, okay? That would be sort of, sort of the initial way of thinking about it. My claim is that when people talk about the annualized return, what is the typical return over, let's say, a K-year period? Okay, if you sample the return every year, is to use the geometric mean instead of the arithmetic mean. What is the arithmetic mean?
This is the one that you're used to computing. A plus B plus C divided by 3 is the arithmetic mean. The geometric mean is the product of A times B times C, taking the cube root of it. Okay? Now, why is one better than another? Okay? Let's try to reason this thing out. Because when I see these things, it doesn't immediately resonate with me. Okay? What our claim is, if we think about the annualized return, what would be the property that we would want to have the annualized return being? The average return over a period of time. We would want that property to be something that, if we had that exact return each year, we would get the same over the period. We would get the same return as we saw over a particular period. Does that make sense, that that's the desirable property that we want? Okay? If I have a return where, a return of 0.1 the first year, 0.2 the second year, and 0.4 the third year, okay? The annualized return, the average return, the property that I would like to have, is if I knew my starting price, okay, and I knew my ending price, okay, that it would be the same as if I had this, it would be the percent, the annualized return rate would be the one that if I had it 3 years in a row, okay, if I every year earned at that rate, I had the same return over the period. Does that make sense? So what is that going to be? If I'm going to have the same return every year, I'm going to be raising that return basically to the kth power. Does everybody agree with that? And so if once we view that, then this, I think, makes a lot more sense. Okay? That the geometric return, the annualized return, is going to be the product of the 1 plus the return each year, okay, raised to the 1 over kth power, which is the same as taking the kth root, right? And the kth root, remember, is some number that when you multiply it by k, you multiply this thing k times, you get the original amount. Any questions about that? Okay? So I argue that it now makes sense why we would use the geometric mean of returns. Okay? Any questions here? And this is a general, again, this may seem to you, I don't know, trivial, or it may seem to, you know, sort of annoying and stuff like this. Why can't I just take means of everything? It's going to be important when we analyze this data that we think a little bit about what we're doing, okay, and look and see whether results pass a Smith test, okay, rather than just, you know, as computer scientists, we like writing programs, pumping numbers through them, and immediately printing out the numbers and saying, look, we have numbers, okay? Here it's going to be necessary to think a little bit about that, okay, especially if there's money writing it. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? The reason why this comes up again, in general, computer scientists know relatively little statistics, okay? I mean, I took a statistics class and I forgot everything. Many of you, the only difference I suspect is that many of you probably didn't have the statistics class to begin with. Okay? Now, why is it that computer scientists know very little statistics? Okay? And I think the reason is that most of the phenomena associated with computer systems are fairly obvious phenomena. Your program works or it doesn't work, right? That is not a statistical phenomena, okay? When you want to look at, let's say, network traffic, okay? You know, basically you're happy to look at a graph, but not there's not really a subtle phenomena that you're trying to discern. Where statistical reasoning really comes up is when you have a phenomena that is not obvious. Okay, what the meaning of it is. Is it obvious that network traffic got higher during the day than at night? Yeah, look at the graph, that's obvious. Okay? Is it obvious if you have a drug that, you know, cured 8 out of 56 terminal cancer people in the control group where 3 out of 32 of them were normal, you know, sort of, you were not treated, were cured. Is it obvious that your drug did something or not? Okay, that's a more subtle kind of a question, and that's why these people care about statistics. Any questions here? The phenomena we're going to deal with in these classes are often subtle enough, we are going to have to actually be a little bit more honest about the statistics than just taking the mean of everything. Any questions? Okay, good. So we have this notion of the annualized return as being the geometric mean. The geometric mean, it seems like it's a relatively hard thing to compute because it's the product of a bunch of things raised to the kth power. How do you compute the kth power of something? Okay, well, not the kth power, the kth root of something. Okay, this is where we get into logarithms, just to remind ourselves. Basically, if we want to compute this, this is really the same thing as the exponential function of the log of this thing. So what is the log of this thing? Well, the log of A times B is log A plus log B, correct? So that gives us, turns us products to sums, okay? And the log of something to the kth power is going to be that k times the log of the remaining thing. So this is basically going to be e to the this, okay? And this reduces our problem to the sum of logs. Any questions about that? I don't think everyone's
right.
This term, the sum of logs, the claim is, can sort of be approximated by the sum of the returns, okay? Because these numbers are small. There's some Taylor series expansion argument. And somehow, as I remember way back from calculus, is that if you have a Taylor series where the terms are small, somehow the first term of the Taylor series matters, okay? It's all that matters, and you can approximate it. So this is somehow supposed to be another approximation. That's something I don't know by feel, okay, so I would treat it this way. Any questions? Okay, good. What other notions of returns might we have? Okay? Another way that we can think about returns, to take our original price time series, instead of converting it to returns, we can talk about converting it to log returns, okay? Which is basically the natural logarithm of 1 plus the return, okay? What is interesting about that? Well, first of all, the log return at any given point is basically the log of the price of today minus the log of the price yesterday. So it's fairly easy to compute log returns, okay? It has certain nice properties because the multivariate log return, okay, is just going to be the sum of the log returns instead of the products of the returns that we had talked about before. Does everybody agree with that? Any questions about that? Okay. In general, it's easier to compute the sums of things than the products of things for numerically stable reasons, reasons of numerical stability. So that's one reason why this might be a better thing to think about. Any questions? Okay. The other is that these log returns might have properties that are interesting studying of themselves. Okay, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Any questions? Okay. What other properties of returns can we have? Okay, this is sort of summarize a little bit. When we compute the return of a stock, okay, we really should factor things like the dividend into the price to return. Does everybody agree with that? Because we've talked a little bit about it, when you have a stock issues a dividend payment, the price of the stock drops. If you don't factor in the dividend, what is going to happen here is that somehow you would see a drop when in fact the return of that day was actually may have been zero or positive. Okay. So in fact, if you really want to compute the return right, the return for a given day is the price that day plus any dividend payments, okay, over the, you know, that in the previous day. Any questions? Now, in general, the data, it's often hard to keep track of dividend payments. Okay, we saw, for example, the virtual stock exchange did not even try to keep track of dividend payments, okay? And so one nice thing of thinking about returns versus stock prices is if you think about, let's say, what would be the stock price, here's, let's say, the total value of what you own in a world of you know, let's say something where it paid off with dividends, it should grow exponentially. Now, every time you get a dividend payment, if you ignore it, okay, the value of the total value of all those dividends over time will accumulate and cause you to misestimate the total amount of what you owned at this time. Does that make sense? Now, if we plot this as returns, what happens? It's probably the case that whenever there's a dividend, you grossly, and suddenly there's this weird, sudden one-day drop, okay? But otherwise, the rest of the time series looks okay. Everybody see what I mean? People see what I mean, or am I mumbling hopelessly? Have people both been mumbling? Have people supposed to see what I mean? Okay. So I argue that we'll in general have to worry about that. If we don't worry about that right, we're still better off, I think, using returns rather than raw price data. Any questions? That's not to argue your products. You shouldn't try to take that into account. But, yes?
We actually looked at returns because we thought stock prices were, actually it came to be an exponential function, so what happened to be in the medium, and then we introduced stock with the distributed market and shape the nature of the market.
Well, now the question here, though, is are you changing the nature of the function if you now take logs returns? Okay? First of all, how do logarithms compare to, how does the function and its logarithm differ when the value of the thing is small? Okay? Let's look at what the log function does. Okay? The linear function does that. What does the log function do? Okay? It sort of goes through 0 and 1, as I recall, and then slowly diverges. The difference between the log and the linear functions for small numbers probably shouldn't be that extreme. Okay, does that seem reasonable? People who know something sort of agree with me, or any comments about that? Okay, so that's an argument that you might not expect. If returns are going to be small numbers, the log return is not necessarily a lot weirder than regular returns. Okay, any questions? I would think that for purposes of analyzing returns, you know, sort of for things like dividends and stuff like that, it's probably easier for us to think about returns than to think about log returns. Okay, so I would say probably for most of your experiments, you should probably think about log, think in terms of returns. Okay, although we will talk about log returns hopefully a little later today. Any questions? Okay, but for things that you want to understand, I think it's easier for you to understand returns. Any questions? Okay. The other thing that sometimes people talk about is the excess return. So you might want to plot, instead of, let's say, the return, okay, of a asset, you might want to plot its excess return relative to some other asset. Okay? So, for example, a typical case is you might think of one of these assets, your reference asset, as being the risk-free rate. You would plot what is your return relative to the return from the risk-free rate. You know, this way you know whether or not betting on this other asset. The real question is you're earning more than the risk-free rate if your returns are positive. Okay? You're doing worse than the risk-free rate if your returns are negative. Does everybody understand that? That seems like a reasonable thing to think about. The excess return can be thought of as the payoff of a strategy where you go long in the asset and short on the reference asset. Okay? So if you ever see in analyzing, you do some strategy or something like this, and you see something which gives you large excess returns by using the options that we have talked about, you should be able to know how to profit from a positive excess return. Any questions? Done? Good. Now, one aspect of returns or probability distributions that we have looked at
Everyone here has had a probability course at some point, okay? And again, you've probably forgotten a lot of that, but probably less than with the statistics, okay? But one thing that we're going to be, I mean, again, in probability, we talk about a random variable, which is a function, a numerical function, where you have a value of the function at any given value, you know, and the probability of what that value, that function being achieved is, right? So if I think about what probability, you know, a random variable is, there is a random variable is something like, let's say, the height of a typical, height, okay? And there are certain values of height that are achievable, okay? And for each value of height, there's a probability that a random person has it, right? Okay, the probability that someone measures at 6 feet may be, you know, sort of 0.04, okay? And 6'1 is 0.03. Okay, or something like this. Okay? So, we're going to be interested in several different moments of random variables in here. And what do we mean by moments? Well, the first moment of a random variable is the mean, okay, or the expectation of that random variable. Okay? And the moment of a random variable is going to be for we integrate over all possible values of x. Okay? What is the value of x of l times the probability, okay, that the random variable took on the value of x? Okay? So this is sort of a probability function. This is the value. If l equals 1, what is the integral of x times the probability of x? That is, I claim, going to be the mean. Everybody, does that fit everybody's understanding? I know people don't like to see integrals if they're a computer science person, okay? But if it was a sum, nobody would have any trouble here, right? Any questions? Okay? So the first moment is the mean or the expectation. In general, we're going to be interested in what they call the elf central moment of a random variable, which is going to be how much is it. We're going to take the mean out of this. We're going to take for every value, we're going to see how much does it deviate from the mean, okay, and raise that to the elf power, okay? So the second central moment, okay, if we want to sum up what is the difference, the integral of the probability of x times the value of x from the mean, how far does that differ from the mean, we start talking about the variance. Okay? So when people talk about second moments, what they're talking about is the variance of the data set. Okay? Any questions here? Okay? Again, you've all heard of variance. You know that the variance is the square of the standard deviation that you all know of. You know it's computed by some kind of a function, where basically what you do is once you have first computed the mean, you see, what is the absolute value of the differences, something like the average absolute value of the difference of the value from the mean, okay? And what variance measures, as far as I'm concerned, is how far does the random variable jump around from the mean, okay? So again, we can sort of imagine two different probability functions. One of them, probability density function, one of them has all their mass right at the mean, another one of which has half its mass a distance of d from the mean and half the mass d from the mean in the other direction. The mean of these two distributions could be the same, but we agree they can look quite a bit different, right? And so somehow the variance is going to give us some measure of how they differ. Okay? Any questions about that? Where have we talked about variance as being something to think about? Have we mentioned variance so far here? Excuse me? Variance was sort of a measure of risk, right? Somehow that if you think of your asset price as a given point, okay, the price is jumping around. If the price is not jumping around, you're a calm person, okay? You're incurring little risk, right, at any given time. The price is relatively stable. If it's varying a lot, even if the mean is the same, okay, there is somehow much more risk associated with that.
So we're going to be interested in general in the notion of variance as correlating with risk, okay, or financial terms. Any questions here? Okay? There are two other second moments that you've heard of when you took a statistics class, but quite possibly never really thought about. Oh, I never thought about really except for the funny names. Okay? The third moment, okay, of a central moment of a random variable is called its skewness. Okay? And it measures how symmetrical, okay, the distribution is. Okay? So we can sort of imagine when we look at a standard bell-shaped curve, somehow when we think about distributions and things like that, we usually think about bell-shaped curves, right? One of the nice things is that it is somehow symmetrical. You could imagine a world where this size looks quite lumpy. Okay? Maybe there's the same mass, the expectation of this or that might be the same. Okay? But if this side looks different than that, the skewness statistic is supposed to show up. Okay? Even though the mean and variance might be unchanged. Okay? Any questions? The final statistic, the fourth central moment, measures something called the kurtosis. Okay? Which is a measure of how much mass there is at extreme values of a distribution. Okay? So what does that mean if I were to draw a picture like this? Here we've got, let's say, a normal distribution. If we thought about the weird distribution that I had over here, okay, remember when I had shown this one here? The mean was the same as the normal distribution. It would be zero, right? The variance, I suspect that depending upon where I put this thing, okay, I would probably, could make the variance probably similar. Okay, does everybody sort of believe that? Okay, somebody who knows something about that believe that? Yeah, okay, so I think I believe that, okay? But I would argue that the as far as symmetrical, is every bit as symmetrical as the other one, so the skewness should be the same. The difference, I would argue, would show up in the kurtosis statistic, okay? Because this would have sort of more mass further out, okay, than the normal distribution. Does everybody agree with that? So in some sense, these are statistics that we can compute about any time series, okay? Okay, let's say we're any... Because there isn't really even necessarily a notion of time. These are observations. It's sort of correlation of time as a variable is being ignored here. Okay? But if we think of a bunch of measurements as, you know, returns, we can compute these statistics and they tell us something about the distribution. Any questions about that? Okay, good. So rapid response team, how much time do you need? And you have 10 minutes and you have a slides, right? Okay, so wait a minute. I'll give you 10 minutes when it's 10 minutes. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Good. So basically what we know about these functions and stop returns, what would we expect the properties, the empirical properties of asset returns, things like stock prices, measured by returns, what would we expect them to be if we think about the daily returns, okay, that you would expect on stocks? I think I would argue that the expected value, okay, is going to be, in general, fairly close to zero. Why is that? Okay? In general, you know, if you think about it, if you have a good year in stocks, your stock goes up 10%. That's considered a good year by any rational person. Maybe not over recent years, but that's a normal amount that's reasonable. If we divide that 10% return over 360 days, how much return is that per day? You know, small, right? And in a world where there's going to be jumping up and down, you know, it wouldn't be obvious to someone eyeballing it that the return each day, is expected return, is not going to be zero. Does everybody sort of agree with that? So in general, especially the finer and finer we slice this thing, the expected value should be returned zero, near zero. Any questions? Do we expect a symmetry between positive and negative returns? I guess let's ask a point here. Do people think positive, you know, if you were to look, they get a plus, the return, the frequency of each return. Here we have on this side, okay, the return, here is a return of 1%, 2%, 3%, minus 1%, minus 2%, dot, dot, dot. Would you expect the frequency of those to be symmetric? How many people say yes? How many people say no? Okay? You say no, why do you say no? Okay, so one argument would be that if we assume that it's positive, we would probably expect that there would be more, perhaps there would be some skewing, okay? In general, we would expect the mean is not actually going to be exactly zero. That's really what you're basically saying. Since the mean is not zero, you're sort of picturing that the curve is sort of shifted over, right? And for that reason, there's going to be more mass on the left, on the positive side than the negative side, right? That's probably reasonable. I would argue that grossly you still expect to see a bell-shaped curve, right, when we're talking about the shifting. Do you agree with that? Or? Okay, so that I think we're in agreement. Okay? The other thing that I think we would expect is that smaller absolute returns will occur more frequently than larger absolute returns. Does everybody agree with that? That the odds that the market goes changes by 1%, okay, is going to be greater than the odds that it's going to change by 2% that day. Does everybody agree with that? So if we believe that I claim is going to suggest a bell-shaped curve. Okay, does everybody sort of agree with that? Now, what bell-shaped curve are we talking about? Okay, and this I claim is something that gets to be kind of interesting. When we talk about bell-shaped curves, in general, we talk about the normal distribution. Okay? What is the normal distribution? Okay? The normal distribution, everybody has sort of seen it. Okay? And again, if you're a computer scientist, you probably don't like it so much. Okay? But basically, what a normal distribution is a probability density function, okay, that is parameterized by two things. Okay? It is parameterized by a mean, and it is parameterized by a standard deviation. Okay? You know, the mean that tells you where the center of it is. Okay? So she was sliding the mean around here. Okay? The standard deviation tells you something about how flat, how dispersed the values are around the mean. Does everybody understand that? So what would a high standard deviation look like? A peaked, sharp peak or a flat peak? A flat peak, right? Higher standard deviation we get, you know, expect to get something broader, okay? And what we expect is the properties of the normal distribution that we expect is that it is centered around the mean, it is symmetrical, and it has tails which go out infinitely far. Okay? Does everybody sort of agree with this? Now, what does that mean by tails? I mean, again, if I look at this formula, okay, this is going to tell me what's the probability that I am, what is the frequency of a particular value, okay? At the mean, okay, I'm going to get e to this thing. Okay, it's going to, there's going to be a value here. I argue that as you get, x gets smaller, gets larger and larger in absolute magnitude, this probability is going to get smaller and smaller, but it will not go to zero. That's what they mean by arbitrary tails. Any questions about that? Okay. What's interesting about the normal distribution, any questions about the normal distribution? Property of the normal distribution that turns out to be interesting and important is that that the standard deviation captures a lot about what the probability is that you're going to be far from the what the probability is that you're close to the mean. Okay,
In particular, what is the probability that is it?
If you have a normal distribution, it is always the case that if you consider the probability mass, one standard deviation to the left of it or one standard deviation to the right of it, you will get about two-thirds of the total probability lying within that mass. Okay?
Does everybody sort of understand what I mean?
That means that you can make a good chance that if you pick a random element, it is going to be within one, the value of it is going to be within one standard deviation of the mean. Okay? Any questions about that? Now, again, if we think about some other non-normal functions, okay, is that really necessarily true? We can imagine a probability density function where, all the mass is out here. Okay? The standard deviation is going to be high, but I argue that there's no guarantee. So what makes the normal curve interesting is that there's a lot of probability. Okay, the probability is captured by the standard deviation. Approximately two-thirds of the probability mass lies within one standard deviation of the mean. Approximately 95% of the probability mass lies within two standard deviations of the mean. And approximately only 1 in 10,000, if you have a random sample, only 1 in 10,000 points will lie more than four standard deviations from the mean. Okay? So we know that it's extremely rare to be too many standard deviations away from the mean. Does everybody understand that if it's a normal distribution? Okay, good.
So my question for you is, what do we know about life? Okay, is it normal or not normal? Okay?
So first of all, do we expect that human heights are normally distributed? Okay? See a lot of nodding. What is the average human height? Let's take a guess. I mean, I don't expect it here.
11.
What? 5'11"? Okay, let's round it up. It's 6 feet, okay? Just because it's, the mean is going to be 6 feet, right? What is the variance? What would we like to think the standard deviation of human height is? I don't have any idea. Does someone want to guess? Maybe 6 inches, right? Okay, I think I believe that. Okay? Let's see if we believe this. If it's true, that would mean that 60%, if it's normally distributed, that would mean that 67% of the people lie with somewhere between 5'6 and 6'6. Do we believe that? I think that may even sound a little bit high. Okay? Obviously, that's probably a little bit high. But now, it's a big ballpark, okay? So the standard deviation is 6 inches or 5 inches. It's not a foot. That much we've now agreed on, right? And do we believe that, do we think that there's a bell-shaped curve here? Yes, certainly human height is going to be a bell-shaped curve. Do we believe that it's normally distributed? Well, seems reasonable, but in what ways might it not be normally distributed? Yeah? Well, one thing that's true is it doesn't have an infinite support in that direction, right? Is there anybody who is less than 0 inches tall? Okay. What? And more than 8 feet, there are no people, you say. Well, this I don't think is really a hard limit, actually. Because if you think about it, let's think about whether we believe this. First of all, I believe that the biggest person ever was like 8'11". Has anybody been to Guinness Book of World Records? Does that sound right? I think that's right, until you prove it otherwise. I'll claim that's right. Well, but there's also a statistical limit, I claim. What is how many standard deviations away from the mean is, that? So 8'11" was how many deviations? It's about 6, right? Okay? That's extremely, extremely rare. It is not obvious to me that, if it's 1 in 10,000, it's 4 deviations away. You know, I don't know, does anybody know what the probability is of something being 6 sigma? three in a million? Okay, so it's not quite the right statistic in that direction. But as we said, our standard deviation was probably pretty high, right? If it was, in fact, 4 inches instead of 6 inches, that would make it another couple of standard deviations away. I'm not convinced that it's wrong on that side. I am convinced it's wrong on this side, right? There's a hard limit here, okay? But basically, I argue that that heights probably are fairly accurately modeled by a normal distribution. Does everybody sort of agree with that? I think anthropologists will agree with me on this one. Okay? Any questions? Now, what about something else? Let's think about something else. Okay? What about income? Is income going to be modeled by a bell-shaped curve? Let's think about that. Suppose we plot income in the United States. What is the average income? 30,000? Okay. Let's be optimistic. Well, actually, this is president. It's hard to tell. But okay. But that said, okay, 30,000 is probably more accurate then. Okay. Fine. So let's say the mean is 30,000. What is the variance, let's say, in income? Okay. If we want to think about this thing. Okay. If we want to use our normal assumption, what is the range over which it would be the case that about two-thirds of the incomes would be satisfied? Okay, someone want to make a guess? What? 15,000 to 200,000? To 100,000. I think that 100,000 is a lot rarer than you think, okay, if we think in the United States, okay? To be honest, like all of you are looking smug here, thinking, huh, I'm going to get that when I get out here. But actually, I would argue that that's actually probably a little bit high. But I would imagine two-thirds of the population, if I were guessing it, I might say somewhere between, I'll just guess 15K and probably about 70K, okay, for two-thirds, if you want to do that, okay? So I would say the standard deviation is what? Somewhere around 30K, 40K, something like that. You want to argue 50K, right? Okay. Do we believe that we would get a bell-shaped curve for income? Well, what would it look like? What would the income look like? The probability distribution for income look like? Yeah. You think it's going to look a little skewed to the right? It's probably going to look something like, I think what you're saying is there's probably going to be more people. First of all, there's no, you know, there's probably a lot of people who make nothing, okay? But there's no one who makes less than nothing, okay, we'll say. That seems like a natural, if we count income the way we normally count income, that's probably true. Okay, probably a little flip here, actually, if I had to make a guess, okay? But we would also expect, there's somehow this sense that it is bell-shaped curve, probably extending a little bit more lopsided in that direction, right? Everybody agree with that? Well, but let's think about something like differently. So I argue it is a bell-shaped curve. We both agree it's sort of bell-shaped looking, less actually looking than before. Would we expect this property of nobody being too many standard deviations from the mean to hold? What is 6 standard deviations from the built-in assumption here? That is going to be something like, what, 300,000 or something like this? That we agree was corresponding. Someone who earned $300,000 was going to look like an 8-foot, 11-inch person here. Okay, and we don't believe that, do we? Okay, there are people who earn $300,000. A year. There are people who earn $1 million a year. There are people who earn $10 million a year. Okay? There are probably, I mean, Bill Gates is worth $100 billion, and he didn't live 100 years, right? It's an argument somewhere along the line he was earning more than $1 billion a year, right? So I argue that even though you've got a bell-shaped curve here, it is not a completely normal curve. Does everybody agree with that? And so one of the things that will drive financial analysis is that we were going to get returns that are not normally distributed. Any questions about that? Okay, so that should, I think, now be sort of believable. Again,
stock returns are not going to be normally distributed because, again, there is a lower bound on return of -1, but no upper bound. That we sort of had done. There's two other good reasons to believe that stock returns are not normally distributed. One is there's a philosophical problem, which is if we assume that daily returns are normally distributed, we have shown that multiple period returns are the product of those daily returns. Does everybody agree with that? That would argue that the distribution of multi-day periods is going to be given by the product of normal variables. And if you understand statistics, which I don't, the claim is that is not normally distributed. Someone who knows what I'm talking about agree with that? Or, okay? People are nodding, so they may or may not know what they're talking about. But any question? The other question is that historically, just like with Bill Gates, there is empirical evidence to show that fatter tails, okay, occur, okay, that there are fatter tails on stock returns. There are the probability that we are going to have a stock crash is much greater than you would expect if you just sort of assume a normal distribution on returns, right? So everybody sort of agree with it. That's where the issue of pertosis comes in, okay? Any questions? So if you want to model for stock returns, I will argue that price is not quite right. Any questions? Okay. Let's see. You said you needed 10 minutes? How much time do we have here? You willing to do it next time? Is that next time? Okay. Tell you what. Let's have you go next time. I'll leave it at that. Okay. Any questions about stock prices now? I'm sorry about that if I gave you a scare, but unnecessarily. Any questions about stock prices, the behavior of these things? Okay. So the empirical thing that we should be seeing here is that there is something that in modeling this, the simplest, on some level, the simplest model is not going to be the right model. Okay, the simplest model of stock returns that I would have would be a binomial distribution, a normal distribution. Okay? And that we would still get a certain amount of insight by assuming that. Right? Remember earlier in class I talked about with mite-based mathematical modeling would be that you would use the simplest model at first and see how well it goes. I would probably, if I were starting to model stock prices, would be to assume that they're normally distributed, okay, and see how far that takes you, okay? You can predict a lot of things if you did assume that they were normally distributed. For example, you would have a but on some level that model is going to break down and you're going to need a more sophisticated model. Any questions about that? Okay, so why don't we say that next class we'll start to talk about a couple of more sophisticated models and other time-series analysis tools, and also talk about the database of financial returns that we have. Some people for your projects, I'm hoping everybody has given me a proposal today, or will give me a proposal. If you need a copy of the database and don't have one, I have some copies of the database now. So come by and talk to me after class. Okay, thank you. I'll see you next class.